This man that's telling the story is a small man, and he remembers sadly his childhood. He said in the classes that he was in, that the teacher would generally pick two strong boys to be captain of dodgeball, kickball, or softball. And then they would, the two would get up, and then they'd choose and pick. He would always be left unchosen. And then the teacher would have to say, well, you kind of take, I'm not going to mention his name, so in case someone has the same name. Somebody's got to pick him. And then somebody would sort of kick the sand and say, oh, well, we'll take him. Now, can you imagine how humiliating that was for him? And apparently that went on for a number of years. That nobody would ever choose him. It was very demeaning. And then they would put him out in right field, behind the right fielder. And he rarely ever got a chance to bat. And a few times he would get a chance to bat, he'd strike out, and they'd laugh at him. Now, you can imagine how he felt all his life. But now he says he's happy because he knows that God has chosen him. And I was taking that analogy to us, because God did not call the mighty or the great. He called us. We have been chosen. And we should be happy about that. And, those choices back in elementary school, they really weren't that important. This is the choice, to be chosen for God's team. This is the choice that matters the most. And I just say, wow. And let's not ruin this great opportunity. Today I want to talk about the calling of two men that altered the world, and at least a few of the lessons that apply to us today. And I believe that this is a more than the average sermon is, I hope, profound. So I'm not going to tell any jokes. In spite of that, I want you to listen very carefully to what I have to say, because I think it's serious. Not that jokes are bad, but the first one I'm talking about is Joseph. We can go to Genesis 37 and read about Joseph. All of you know the story, but I just want to focus on some of the lessons of Joseph's life. Genesis 37, verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And his brothers saw that their fathers loved him more than he loved the others. And it was true. He did love, because he was the son of, he had several wives. Wife he favored, the son of his old age. He was the baby of the family, the favorite. And you all know about sibling rivalries and jealousies, right? You all understand that. And to make matters worse, in verse 5, Joseph has this vision, this dream, of everyone's sheaf, that's all of his brothers, bowing down to him. And he told them about it. Oh, that made them love him even more. You could imagine. It went over very well. What was even worse, he had another dream about the stars in heaven. Everybody bowed down to him. Let's read that in verse 11. Genesis 37, verse 11. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his mind. In other words, his brothers were even more outraged. And actually, his dad kind of rebuked him. You really shouldn't be saying that. Robert, I'm bowing down to you. But his father kept it in his mind. And maybe there's some truth behind it anyway. But it wasn't wise of him to tell his brothers that. So much so that what they plotted and planned, to murder him. Before we get to that, realize that his destiny, that is Joseph's destiny, was to be a great ruler if he remained faithful to God throughout his life. And that's true of us. We have the same destiny to become a great ruler, like Joseph, if we can remain faithful to God. We have to navigate deceptions, trials, and pressures, even from close friends and relatives and others. Well, what they did was they threw Joseph in a pit, and at least one or two of the brothers, Reuben and Judah, I think, realized that maybe murdering him wasn't such a great idea. That's fratricide. They said, let's sell him into slavery. They might have actually thought that was even worse than killing him. So he goes off to slavery. Now, here's what I want to say. As far as all the evidence in the story goes, as far as we know, Joseph never lost his faith. He kept being a man of God, even in all aspects of his life. Not just, you might say, when he was in church, but all aspects of his life. He kept being a man of God. He did not get bitter. And in Genesis 39, 3 and 4, he was sold to the Pharaoh's captain of the guard. And he acted as so much a man of God. He impressed his master so much that he became the chief administrator and the boss. In other words, however that worked out, he was in charge of his household and maybe a lot of things logistically to do with the guard, with Pharaoh's guard. I mean, he was someone that people could look at him and see how he handled his business, and they knew he was a man of God. Can people deal with us over a period of years and know that we are men of God? Are we only godly on the Sabbath? We're other things during the rest of the week. In verse 9 through 13, there's one more thing about Joseph. He was also very handsome. Now, probably he had charisma if he got leadership that well. But he was also very handsome. And the captain of the guard's wife decided she wanted him, and he tried to avoid her. But eventually, you know, you all know the story. And, she was angry, of course, because of that. Probably with the morality of the world she lived in, that's probably not what she expected to happen. He was a slave, and he's refusing me. So the point is, I really don't think that Potiphar actually fully believed his wife. Or he probably would have killed Joseph. But he was put in a position where he had to do something. So he threw him in prison. Now, most people at that point would be discouraged, right? They would give up. You know, I thought God was with me. I was going to do something great. And look what God has allowed to happen to me. You go to verse 22. It happens again. Joseph is such a man of God that the warden of the prison makes him the boss. He's now running the prison. All the dealings. They don't have to worry about a thing. Joseph makes it run smoothly. And we should try to be, in everything we do, men of God so that others can see it. Now I'm going to go to Genesis 40. He eventually, because of things he does in prison and revealing inspired dreams, he goes before Pharaoh and interprets the dream. Let's go to Genesis 41, verse 37. Genesis 41, verse 37. Now, this is after he's interpreted the dream about the seven lean years and the seven good years. By the way, you know that, and I'm sure Joseph probably explained this beautifully to Pharaoh. He says, we're going to have seven great years with more food than anybody can eat. But you know how people are. If they have plenty, they'll just eat it all up anyway or waste it. So the seven great years are just going to be wasted. People will just eat it all up and waste it. And then seven lean years will come and we'll starve to death. And you know, obviously he probably elaborated, you know, in detail. And Pharaoh was so impressed. Notice what he says. And then he makes a suggestion about Pharaoh about saving the good years for the bad years. And probably put some details in. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants, you know, his top staff. Verse 38, then Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit or the spirit of God? Because Pharaoh probably asked for a report on Joseph before he called him, and probably his previous life in Egypt, and they probably told him what a great guy he was and that he was a godly man and God blessed what he did. And Pharaoh made him viceroy of Egypt. He was number two, just behind Pharaoh. He was a ruler in Egypt, and he ruled Egypt the rest of his life and made Egypt wealthy, wealthier than it would have been, because Pharaoh got a ton of money when they sold the extra grain during the 7 years of famine from all the nations surrounding Egypt. And then the government got greater control over the economic life of the people. So Pharaoh got wealthy and powerful thanks to Joseph. And so we should try to be godly people in our secular life. You don't want to be someone who's very churchy on the Sabbath, but during the week, you will cheat your customers any way you can get away with it. I mean, there are people like that. Some of them even use Jesus' name when they cheat you. Well, or they'd say we're just getting a little more than we should, but I wouldn't want to do anything like that. But he was a man in whom God was obviously working. He laid the foundation for the nation of Israel because he basically brought what was a large family into Egypt, and they got the favored land because, you know, Joseph was favored, and they got good land. And that family became a great nation. They went from just a large family in Egypt, and centuries later, they became a great nation of millions of people. Now, some later pharaoh put them into slavery, partly because they were growing stronger physically. And even after you put them in slavery, they still were growing stronger physically. They were having more kids, and they were healthy, and the pharaohs got afraid of them. Now, I'm not saying they grew strong spiritually. That may be another story. But they grew strong physically and in numbers and in health. So, in a sense, Joseph laid the foundation that made the nation of Israel what it was. Also, by them coming out of slavery, they were willing to accept God's covenant. Because if they had been a very successful, wealthy, happy nation, and God had come along, they might have said, well, you know how human nature is. You need God most when you are feeling oppressed, when the pressures of sin are on you. And there's actually a biblical analogy of baptism when they crossed the Red Sea, came out of slavery. The analogy for us is clearly we are slaves to sin, and then we get baptized, and then we go into freedom because sin has its price on us. So that's the great thing that Joseph did. The second man is Moses. Let's look at the choosing of Moses. We're going to go to Exodus 3, the calling of Moses. Exodus 3. We're going to pick it up in verse 13. And, of course, it's a great story. And I remember seeing this in the movie The Ten Commandments. And I guess I was maybe like 8, 9, 11, 12, or 13 when I first saw the movie, but it was impressive. Except for one thing, which I'll explain in a minute. Verse 13. I think that was a great movie. By the way, this hand shook Charlton Heston's hand. I got to shake Moses' hand, the movie star. When I was in Vietnam, he said, "It's an honor to meet you, Lieutenant Ricks." And anyway, we chatted. But then Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now, they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?" First of all, it's obvious that Moses doesn't know God's name, or he wouldn't ask the question. Now, people might try to dance around that scripture, but it's quite clear. And this is 500 and some years after Abraham. So it's clear that Moses doesn't know the name, or he wouldn't ask. So you got to get that in your mind clearly. Moses does not know the name. Verse 14, "And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent you to me." When I saw that in the movie, The Ten Commandments, it didn't seem to make any sense. I mean, what kind of name is I am who I am? Obviously, that's an English translation of it. Now, I'm going to go to the Hebrew. I'm using Strong's Hebrew lexicon because it's probably the best standard for classical Hebrew. It's 1961. The word is Hayah. It's a primitive root word. And here's the definition out of Strong's. To be, become. It's the emphatic of to be. And it's an emphatic word. It's an emphatic verb, first person pronoun. And I think it means to exist or probably always to exist. I am, if you think about it, always to exist. And, of course, he was speaking Hebrew. By the way, just for the record, Abraham did not speak Hebrew. He was a Chaldean. He spoke Chaldees. The Hebrew language didn't even exist when Abraham came out of all this is important when we get into the language part of it. Hebrew as a language came into existence from 1000 to 1100 BC. Languages kind of evolve out of other languages, and you can study the root languages of others. For those who aren't familiar with that, think of the Romance languages. Those are big in our world. The Romance languages came out of Latin because of the Holy Roman Empire. The Romance languages are Italian, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. I believe that's the list. To your shock, English and German have a different root, though there's some Latin influence. I'm not taking it totally out. And if you go back to the days of Chaucer and you read some of that stuff, which I've done, English has changed a lot too. So you got to realize language has changed. So there might have been a few root words that have been common, but basically, Abraham would not have known Hebrew. Okay, just so it'll make more sense when I say that. And I think if you look at it from the King James translators, I am is not a bad translation of Haya, because it is a primitive word, you know, to be, or an emphatic to be, or to exist. By the way, it's the same in the New Testament. Different language, but the same meaning. Let's go to the New Testament, John 8:56. We go to the New Testament. It's really interesting to view it in the New Testament. John 8:56. This is Christ having troubled discourse between him and the religious leaders of Judah. John 8:56. So speaking to the leaders of the Jewish people, who of course would have been experts in Hebrew, even if they spoke Greek and Aramaic, the leaders would have been at least. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. The Jews therefore said to him, "You're not even 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham?" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." When he said that, they knew what he meant. They knew what he meant when he said, "I am." He knew exactly what they meant. Now, this is in the Greek. This is also from Strong's Lexicon. I didn't print it out here. But this is in the Greek. The word that was actually spoken by Christ and written by the apostle in Greek was the word, I hope I pronounced this correctly, I, me. It is a first person singular again. And it's the verb to emphasize I exist. And it's emphatic, just like the Hebrew. So, meaning-wise, they're parallel. Do you see that? And so the King James translators were correct to translate both the Hebrew and the Greek as I am. I exist. And so what I think is most important is the meaning of the word. Not so much the language it was spoken in, but the meaning, I am. And I believe Herbert Armstrong and Garner Ted Armstrong were very insightful when they took the meaning of the word I am, and then a word that we're going to come to in a minute, and they said a good way to look at the word is the word eternal. Because, in other words, she eternally exists. Because if you say I am as a name, I realize the translators did the best they could in the meaning, but can you see that that's kind of a hard name to think of? But eternal has meaning. It really does. Let me give you my little example. My son just recently turned 30, and even though he shaves his head bald, you know, because he has to shave, but he realized his hairline has receded all the way back to here. Baldness is in our family. And he's scared. He's getting old. He's only 30 now. Well, he's a little older than that now, but I'm 30. I'm getting old. But that happens to a lot of people. You know, you're a kid. One day you're 30 and you think, wait a minute, I'm not a kid anymore. And then you hit 40 and 50 and you say, ah! Wait till you hit 60 and you'll think, oh. The point I'm making in all that is, now that I'm well in my 60s, you realize that our life is temporary. Say what you will, it is temporary. I'd probably be lucky to get 15 more years. I mean, I'm not that's probably realistic. Maybe only two or three, based on the way some people I know have passed away at my age, same race. But the point is, even if you're in great health, the one thing we know about you, you are temporary. You do not exist permanently. But God exists permanently, and that was the meaning of his name. You know, and I think the Armstrongs did a good job when they translated the meaning as eternal. See how that makes sense? Eternal, because that is the meaning of the name. Going to verse 59, therefore, that is the Jewish leaders. When they heard the word I am, and of course they heard the Hebrew word, I me, and they knew he was paralleling exactly with the Old Testament word, and they therefore picked up stones to throw at him. In other words, that's what you did when you executed people. You stoned them to death. They weren't even going to worry about asking the Romans whether it's legal, because that's blasphemy. He said he was, you know, the God of the Old Testament, the God of Israel. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. In other words, Jesus looked enough like the other Jews that he could hide himself in the crowd and disappear from them. And of course, it wasn't his time to die. So, of course, that's what he did. But they knew what he meant when he said, I me or I am. And I think the meaning of God's name, actually God has a number of names, we'll see that in a minute, but the meaning of God's name is what's really important. And I think that's a biblical truth that our church has understood. We don't talk about it that often, though, and maybe we should talk about it today, at least in this sermon for a minute or so. So we realize that sometimes when you're praying, or just whenever, you can focus on the meanings of God's name, because that's the most important thing spiritually. And I think it'll be best to help the church grow spiritually and grow in understanding. Think about the meaning of God's name. And I want to thank the Armstrongs for that. And by the way, if Joseph put Israel in the incubator to become a great nation, Moses led them out by the millions as their lawgiver. And Moses was a type of Christ. Moses remained faithful under a whole different kind of trials, mostly from his own brethren, as a matter of fact. So should we. Both men were key to the birth of God's people, Israel. And in a sense, you and I will be key, at least we'll be part of it. There may be a whole bunch of others, but we'll be part of the birth of all nations being part of God's family. Because when Christ comes back, he'll start putting the entire world, you know, from North Pole to South Pole, into his family and straightening out the mess that is this world. As we've talked about before in Revelation 3, 9, and 10, you know, he says that, and they will come and bow before you because you are faithful, you know, to Jesus Christ. And that's in the Bible. We're going to be baby gods if we hold on. But it's not going to be easy because Satan is going to throw every kind of curveball and hardball to throw us off the track. So we've got to stay faithful and balanced. Let's go to Exodus 6, 2. Because that's the next part of the story between, name-wise, between God and Moses. Exodus 6, verse 2. God spoke further to Moses. Exodus 6, verse 2. God spoke further to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. And, well, by the way, when the Lord is capitalized, that is the YHVH or YHWH, that's the Tetragrammatron, the sacred name of Israel's God. By the way, you're going to wonder, why did the King James translators put it in capital? I'm going to put myself in their shoes for a minute, then I'll get to the most important part. Whether they're right or wrong, I guess, is to be debated by people. Translating languages is not that easy. My final exam in German was to take a German book, it was a simple book, fortunately, and translate it into English. Do you know that languages are thinking patterns, and they don't, in other words, here's what, at least from my understanding, and I will admit it's just my understanding, but languages are not words that are always simplistically interchanged, so you can have a computer put in the different names, press a button, it'll go from one language to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. It's not that automatic. You got to think about the context, the meaning, the grammar, and other things which you know, I'm probably not the best at. But I survived it and passed. So looking at it from the King James writer's point of view for a second, they realized that that word, it's from that same word we looked at already, Yahweh. I'm going to mispronounce it again. It's easy to get that sort of thing mispronounced. Yes, okay. Hope I said it correctly. Let me look it up again so no one accuses me of saying it wrong. The Hebrew word. They realize that we're now going into the noun form of that verb word. And they realize the word does mean Lord and God, but it also has a bigger meaning. It's the name of the national God of Israel. So to differentiate it from other lords and gods that are in the ancient text, they put it in all capitals. So at least if you know that, and it's, you know, it's in the margins of a lot of books in the front, you know when God's specific national name of the God of Israel is there, and when it's just a more general, generic name for God. So at least the translator, and they could have said, let's just translate it Lord like all the rest. You know, and I thought that was nice of them, so at least you know when it appears. And sometimes that's very helpful, like in, you go to Exodus 31, where God's talking about the God of the Sabbath. It actually helps clarify it a little bit when you see that, because you realize the God of the Sabbath, and that's one of our signs, is the God whose name is the name of the ancient God of Israel, and rather than just God in general. But let me carry on with the meaning of these verses here. God spoke further to Moses, said, I am the Lord, and I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, they're the fathers of the faithful. Abraham was a friend of God. You know, so he was the first man to become close to God, and everything is built around his family. So Abraham is Mr. Big in the pantheon of patriarchs. He says, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is God. Let me start at the beginning. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord, and we'll get to the pronunciation of it in a minute, I did not make myself known to them. This is over a 500-year period between the two. And he's saying, God is telling Moses that they only knew me by El Shaddai, meaning God Almighty. They only knew me as God Almighty. They never knew me by my sacred name. No one knew the name. Let me go to the sacred name. So you're getting around to it slowly. The name that was L-O-R-D, all caps in the King James, is 3068 in Strong's Hebrew lexicon. Now, Strong's says it sounds Jehovah, but other people have other ways of translating it. And the meaning is the self-existent or eternal. So they didn't dream up the word eternal. It's in the commentaries. It's just a good one to use. It means self-existent or eternal. Or the English version, you know, which the translators, I guess, put together, they anglicized it, is Jehovah. And one church has built their entire 80% of their doctrines around that name, Jehovah, which I think is unbalanced, to say the least. But, you know, it's a free country. They can do what they want. Okay. Now, some people wouldn't agree with Strong's. And Strong's, I don't believe the Strong's is saying he knows for certain that it's Jehovah. Some people think it's Yahweh. And there are other, and we'll mention later, there are several other possible Yahweh. There are several other pronunciations. The thing I want to mention right now is the father of the faithful, Abraham, and his sons who followed him, Isaac and Jacob, never knew that name. They never knew the name Jehovah or Yahweh or Yahweh or other pronunciation of it. They never knew it, and yet they were close to God, they were loved by God, and they were saved. It wasn't necessary for their salvation. All they had to know was the meaning, that he was the ever-living God, which I'm sure they knew that under El Shaddai, the meaning. That's all that mattered. Now, possibly one of the reasons they didn't know that name is since the Hebrew language didn't exist in the days of Abraham, at least he couldn't have known that name. That makes sense to you. He just knew him as God Almighty. It didn't exist in Abraham's day. Let me give you a little bit of history of the Bible and language, just a little bit of it. you realize that Adam and Eve did not speak Hebrew, since it didn't come into existence until 1100 B.C. Probably the language that Adam and Eve spoke was probably spoken up until the Tower of Babel. And then God just smashed all the languages of the world and splintered them into, we really don't know how many, but probably hundreds of languages. Which those languages then evolved in different families and have changed because languages change over years. Maybe there were a few common words, but I seriously doubt it. And it was so bad that the people, because God did not like the unity, it was a military unity in a way that God didn't like, and no doubt pagan as well, of course, anti-God, by the way it's written, in the Tower of Babel, and God wanted to divide it. It was so bad, they couldn't even understand each other, probably even in one or two or three simple words. They all had to go their own way with the people who spoke the same tongue. No doubt he divided up by family groups, and that he scattered them all over the world that way. And then classic Greek, classic Hebrew. There are earlier bits of Hebrew, but classic Hebrew came around 1011 B.C. And I mentioned how our Romance languages came out of Latin and the local dialects, and they all blended, and you know how languages go. And then languages are a complicated thing. And I was just trying to read up on it all so I could answer any questions, be ready. It is a complicated mess, languages. And ancient languages are even more complicated because we're further from the evidence, if you know what I mean. But one interesting note, God's national name was given to Moses just at the start of Israel as a nation. Because think about it, and the tongue that they spoke, which is Hebrew, they really weren't a nation when they first came into Egypt. They were a family. But they came out of Egypt as a new nation, the nation of Israel. You know, they had their own tongue, and that's when God gave them a name. And I think we can all spiritually benefit from learning many of the meanings of God's names, which I'll get to later. I had a one semester of Hebrew with Dr. Kaplan. He's a Jewish scholar from New York who was in God's church and did teach at Ambassador College Big Sandy. I don't know where he is now. But here's what almost all the scholars believe. I realize when you say that, there's always a few renegades. I know, I got it all figured out. Here's what happened in the Jewish world. And I'm going to look at it from their point of view. We might be critical of them, but at least try to understand what they did and why they did it. They overemphasized the third commandment, which is not to take God's name in vain. So after a while, they said, if we keep saying God's national name, Jehovah, Yahweh, Yahweh, whatever it is, if we keep saying that frequently all the time, isn't just the repetition going to make it vain? And they say it's just too sacred to say, and the pagans will make it a curse word. The one thing I can say, if you notice, what is the number one curse word on most golf courses? I won't mention it, but you know the two I can think of, right? It's almost like people went out of their way to say, okay, what's God's name? I think I'm, you know what, it just seems that way. People like to blaspheme. So they stopped saying it. Now, they knew the name because, you know, at least the leaders could read it in Hebrew when they read it. But when they read it, they'd say out loud, you know, El Shaddai or some general word that meant God, God Almighty or Lord. They wouldn't say it. So for probably over 2,300 years, it was not spoken. And in Hebrew, the noun parts of Hebrew words, you only have the consonants and not the vowels. And they're not even, there's even a little debate about one of the consonants, but let's just say it's YHWH. Most believe that, or YHVH. You realize when you start playing with sticking the various vowels in there, there's several combinations. Actually, there are about 30. Some of them are tongue twisters that I'll screw up saying poorly because I'm not good at that sort of thing, as I've learned the hard way. But probably the most popular are Yahweh, 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 Yahovah. Those are probably the most popular of the people who speculate. And one group that based pretty much all their theology on the sacred name, 20 years after they started, said, hey, we were wrong, and they changed it to another variation of it. And of course, we argued if it were that vital to God, that there was no doubt how it is pronounced phonetically, he would have preserved it so there's no doubt, because the rest of the Bible is there and there's no doubt. But, you know, if you disagree, at least don't make it a fetish, because I believe it's bad for you. When you force everybody else to say it your way or else. And also, there's one more thing. Even if we figured out the vowels, I mean, we could figure the vowels out right, we still might not make it sound right. Let me give you my bad example. Before we went to Europe, Natalie, who speaks a little French because she learned it in college, we listened to her French tapes, and I learned some French words. We were at this restaurant, and we said, let's order in French. And, of course, Natalie did a pretty good job. She's pretty smart, and she's had more practice at it. The waiter made fun of my French. I had the right word, but it didn't sound right. And if some of you know about French, it's all nasal. It's like, I don't know, you think of it in your nose. You need a big nose to speak French. Maybe not, but I'm probably kidding there. Maybe not. But and of course, he certainly got the tip he deserved, too. Making fun of my French. I gave you more story. What I'm saying is, even if we could guess the right vowels to put between the consonants, you know, 2,300 years, are we sure it's going to sound the way it did when Moses heard it? I'm just saying, I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But I guess that's something to think about. But languages do vary. Friends, I'm going to just mention two words. When you switch them from one language to the other, they sound much different. Like, take Henry. In English, it's Henry. In French, it's Henri. Doesn't that sound beautiful? You say Henri, right? See, my French is getting a little bit better. Maybe. Maybe not. George, someone told me, in English, it's George, but in Spanish, it's Jorge. You see the difference? And actually, I had a little article, a whole bunch of words, but I didn't bring them because it's not necessary. Languages are tricky business, phonetically going one name to the other. And I think it's the meaning of the word. Now, I'm going to go through a bunch of, this is out of an article that our church published, I think GTA wrote it up many years ago, of words in the Bible and the different meanings of God's name. And I think we can use them in prayer. Different meanings of God's name. You can use any sacred name that you want. You think you can figure it out, or God knows what you mean because he understands us. I bet God knows me better than I know myself. My wife certainly thinks she does. I'm in trouble now. But probably Wendell would agree with me there. Okay, let me get to the words before I get in more trouble. El Shaddai, the Almighty, All-Sufficient God. Yah, the Independent One. Now we're into the Yahwehs, and others. I'm just going to substitute the word eternal, but you know what it was, whatever those names I just mentioned before, or some other slight variations of them. It's the Eternal Elohim, Majestic, Omnipotent God. The Eternal Hosanu, Lord, our Maker. Sometimes I pray, I stick my arms up and I say, the God, our Creator, you know, the God of Israel, the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, he knows which God I'm referring to with all those synonyms, or the God, our banner. Let me mention one off a couple more here. Eternal Jirai, the Lord will provide. He's our provider. The Eternal Rafika, the Lord, our healer. That might be a good one to pray privately when you need healing. Remind God he's our healer. Eternal Nisai, the Lord our banner. By the way, when you think of a banner, you know in battle, when your banner is waving, it's for your troops to, you know, the guy that carries the banner, for your troops to focus in that area. As long as your banner is flying, you're still in the battle. You know, you hear that. Matter of fact, the Star Spangled Banner was written because well, originally it started as a poem, then they put the music to it. But it was originally written because the guy was a prisoner aboard a British ship. And by the way, Britain was the world superpower at the time. We just don't remember that today. And the U.S. had no navy. The British Navy was pounding Fort McHenry in Baltimore, and, you know, they were just breaking the place into pieces. And so as he looked through all the – and, of course, Fort McHenry was firing back, but the British were doing most of the firing because they had a lot of ships. As he looked through the fog, he was encouraged. In spite of all-night bombardment, the banner you know, which has later become the American flag, was still flying. Now, think about that when you think about God, our banner. When you want to win, in spite of the battle, remember God's our banner. He's the one we look to. He's going to win for us. Just stay with him. And that's the way to get the meaning out of his name. The eternal Makadishkim, the Lord sanctifies. The eternal Elohenu, the Lord our God. Eternal Elohika, the Lord your God. Eternal Elohe, the Lord my God. Eternal Shalom, the Lord of peace. And I know we probably don't think about the world is at war, and even when this war ends, there'll be another one. I hate to say this, probably discouraging. The Middle East, probably until Christ comes back, will never know any lasting peace. Actually, they're fighting bigger in Lebanon than they are in Iraq right now, but that's the media doesn't cover that. And it's mostly between Islamic people, but I'm not sure of who's on what side. I think the loyal Lebanese Islamic people are fighting some Palestinian group that they think is supported by Al-Qaeda or whatever. And then actually even in Gaza, two separate groups of anti-Israeli parties are fighting each other. Then we go into details. In other words, what I'm saying, the world will not know peace until Christ comes back. I mean, no matter what peace treaty they sign, even if they sign one in 3-4 months and things quiet down for a while, and I believe Satan has especially great influence in the Middle East. And you know his demons are not. And I know that sounds discouraging when I say there'll never be peace in this world till Christ comes back. But that's true. We know it in our gut, don't we? I mean, I hope America can stabilize things and get all those terrorists before they come over here. You know, I'm rooting for America. But I don't expect peace. But Shalom, God is, that's one of his names. He's the eternal God of peace. Eternal Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts. He's also the God of the Sabbath, of course. Eternal Ra, with two A's, the Lord my shepherd. Eternal Mekah, the Lord will smite you. There is reason to be afraid of God, too. You know, I know we think of God as a peaceful God, but there is, the Bible says, a wise man fears God. There is a point when you, if your behavior gets overboard, you need to be afraid of God and bring it back in. The eternal Gamola, the Lord of recompenses. He will recompense our things been done wrongly to us. The Lord Shammah, the Lord is there. Now, there's some Arabic names for God in the Bible, too. God used a number of languages in the Bible, Arabic words. Elah, the adorable one. Abba, it means father in a warm way. Father in a warm way. And Christ actually used that one. There are a bunch in Greek. Let me go through some of the Greek names as well. Theos, the one supreme deity. Kyrios, Lord our master. Pater, father. The word that was translated into English, Jesus, I think it's Iosis in Greek. I won't say my Greek is perfect. But when you change that first letter to J, it sounds like Jesus. Because Greek, the problem that you have with a lot of foreign languages, leave this in my humble opinion, the J, the W, the V, and the H switch all kinds of meanings in different languages. And it tends, especially in German as well, it'll throw you off when you're just reading it. And you just, anyway, that's what I've noticed my short life, because I feel like a kid, but I'm old already. It's hard to believe, isn't it? I was a kid yesterday. I was younger than Wes. It wasn't that long ago. See, being the youngest person here, we can pick on Wes. He's Christos, the anointed Christ, the Messiah. Of course, it comes out in English as Christ, but it's almost just like it is in Greek, Christos. Logos, the spokesman, the word. Archigos, author, forerunner, captain. Hios Theo, son of God. Basileus Basilion, king of kings. Basileus Erinnes, king of peace. Basileus Dikasunes, king of righteousness. Christ is also the king of righteousness. And righteousness will reign on this world when Christ gets here. Right now, You know, the truth is, the best you can have is a government that's a little stupid, a little bureaucratic, a little incompetent. Governments range from that to downright evil, and some of them are even doing genocide, like in places like Darfur. I mean, that's what you have in the world's government, from stupid to evil. And you don't have any truly righteous and godly, in the God sense, governments in this world. Now, some aren't that bad, and we should be lucky we live in a place where the governments aren't that bad. We have freedom of religion, etc. Well, there are places in the world where we'd have to do this secretly, and if they caught us, we could be in big trouble. And more places than you might imagine, by the way, where there's official language, official religion, and they don't, or no religion at all, like in China, they don't want you to buck it. Matter of fact, most missionaries in China, including Terry Gooch's son, who used to be there as a missionary for the Baptists, he had to go as a translator because they want to learn English so they can become richer. And he teaches English. But on the weekend, he would, you know, try to bring some people to Christianity. But he had to do it secretly. I think the Chinese government probably guessed that some of that's going on. But they want English teachers more than they probably need to worry about it at this point. But I just want to let you know, they have the right, if they catch you teaching religion in China, to throw you in jail. And they've done that to a lot of people. Anyway, I could talk more about the freedoms we have that are not everywhere in the world. The eternal Rafika, that's God our healer. And I think in your private prayers, you can use any mixture of names you want, names you like, the ones that you believe are correct, or you can kick around a variation of them. And I think it'll help you get a more personal relationship with God. You know, stick your hands up there and pray to the God, our healer. But I still think the meaning is more important than the phonetic sound, because languages change. And it's hard to nail anything down. I mean, especially when you look, take the long view. And by the way, Paul, and I'm not going to read it because most of you know it, but Paul in 1 Corinthians 14, he actually criticizes the Corinthian church for showing off their gift of languages. And he says, you're all talking in church in languages that nobody can understand. He said, you should talk in a tongue they can understand so that you can edify the church. Don't use language to show off your religion. And if you read 1 Corinthians 14, that's the only conclusion you can come. So remember that spiritually. Don't use it to show off that you're more spiritual than others. I think it gets you off balance. We should prove how spiritual we are, like Joseph, by being a godly man 7 days a week, or a godly woman as best you can, fighting your own weaknesses. Moses laid a great foundation for us. Remember the name, which I guess is anglicized as Jehovah. Remember the meaning is eternal. How great is the eternal? I'm going to show this thing next week to another church, but I won't unwrap it now. Keep it wrapped up. But you look at how big the universe is. And Earth is just, Earth is actually a speck compared to the sun. The sun is a speck compared to a bigger star. That star is a speck compared to a bigger star. And even the biggest star is a speck in something what they call a nova, which probably is small compared to a black hole, which is so enigmatic that I think even the great physicists are kind of trying to figure it out. It's so big, it's so powerful, it seems to absorb light, energy, radio waves, and even time. And I really can't understand that. I'm not that smart. But God controls all of that. And actually, I wasn't going to quote the scriptures so as not to get off the topic, but if you go into the book of Hebrews in the first chapter or so, God says he's greater than the heavens, and the heavens will someday be gone. Someday they'll be old, but God will still remain. He's eternal. And you realize that these stars, from what they're measuring, have been there billions of years, and will probably be billions of years before they burn out. But God will outlast it all. That's how great he is and how eternal he is. And we have a chance to be in his family as baby gods. I say, let's not blow the chance. And by the way, we'll all get new names. Let's go to Zephaniah. It's one of those minor prophets that's hard to find. But there's an important scripture in Zephaniah that I want to mention here. I have a hard time finding it too. But it's in there somewhere before Jonah, I think, and Amos. All right. Did I miss it again? It's amazing how Zephaniah is hard to find. I've missed it several times. You go by it and you pass over it. It's after Daniel, yes. It's right after Habakkuk. Okay. So these people got faster fingers than I do. I've got a Bible with sticky fingers on it. Okay. There it is. Zephaniah. We're going to go to the third chapter of Zephaniah. Zephaniah 3. Since I took so long to get to it, I'm sure you're all there now. Zephaniah 3, verse 8 and 9. Zephaniah 3, verse 8 and 9. This is, of course, a prophecy. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord. For the day when I rise up to pray indeed, my decision is to gather the nations, to assemble the nations, and to pour on them my indignation. Of course, that's talked about in the book of Revelation, in the Battle of Armageddon, the day of the Lord. Most of us know that. That day is coming when God's going to smite the earth. For all the earth will be devoured by the fire, by my zeal. Now, after God smashes the world, like as described in more detail in the book of Revelation, notice verse 9. But then I will give to the people purified language, a pure language, or some translations say purified lips, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord to serve him shoulder to shoulder. Now, you're going to ask, what is that pure language that God is going to give us in the future? Obviously, I don't know. Is it the same language that Paul heard when he had a vision, the heavenly language that Paul mentioned? Is it the language that Adam and Eve got in the Garden of Eden? Obviously, we don't know. We don't know our new names and what will come about. But think about it this way. If Hebrew were a pure, sacred, perfect language, the prophet could not have made that statement. Because, you know, if they had the pure language, wouldn't God say, I'll make all the nations speak the same pure language that you all speak? Right? And we know that Hebrew came, it was quite a while before Hebrew came on the scene. It was well after the Tower of Babel, after languages had been Babelized by God to divide the nations. And languages all have interlocking words. There are some Aramaic words in Hebrew, and the roots are, they have several roots. And even English is not as pure and perfect a language as you think. the point I'm getting at is, we don't really have to worry about it that much. When God gets back, he will give the entire world a pure language. Think of how unifying that will be. There'll be one language, and I presume one dialect, and we'll all know how to address God, probably in all those names that we just mentioned, and maybe even a few more that we may learn between now and then. We'll all be speaking the same. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to promote it. God will bring it when he gets back. We don't have to worry about it. So use your own judgment, since God says work out your own salvation, about how you pray to God. By the way, the New Testament was clearly written in Greek. God's name was written in Greek, the Greek language. Let me explain something, and this is a very important point I want to make. The Greek language was the major international language of the Roman Empire, especially that part of the Roman Empire. If you go to Acts 22, verse 2, Paul is talking to them, and then it suddenly says, and then he spoke to them in Hebrew, and they became more silent. Well, what language was he speaking to them before that? Well, obviously Greek. And by the way, most of the New Testament was written to Greek-speaking churches, and that no one would contend that. Why would Paul write it to them in Hebrew? It was written in Greek, and if it's all right for Paul to use Greek names like Jesus and Christ, it's certainly going to be all right for us, in case anybody tells you you can't use them. Now, there were some dialects of Aramaic around as well. Now, what about those people who say there was a conspiracy, and the conspirators in some of those 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries got all the New Testament together, and they changed it from its perfect, pure Hebrew to Greek, and they changed all the names of God so nobody would know what God's name was? There's one problem with that theory, that conspiracy theory. One is no one had any such power. God made sure that no one could get all the Greek manuscripts. They were scattered throughout the world, the known world of those days. It'd be like, maybe in a smaller way, but the same thing. If someone said, I'm going to write a new Bible, I'm going to make major changes in the Bible. Well, they could do that, but it wouldn't fool anybody because there are millions and millions of Bibles all over the world. People know, well, that's his Bible, and he's changed a bunch of stuff. Well, that's the Catholic Bible, and they took out this, and they changed one of the commandments. You know, everybody would know it. And anybody want to do original, pure translation, they go back to a number of Greek manuscripts that are kept on mountaintop monasteries, you know, under, you know, air-conditioned ways so they won't rot. And all of the ancient manuscripts are in Greek. But here's another problem with that. Let's go to 2 Peter, and then I'll tell you the other part of the problem with saying that someone conspired to change the New Testament into Greek so that they would have the ability to change, hide God's name. God's name is there. The King James translator didn't hide it. They just put it in all caps so you know when it was there. The Lord is not an unfaithful translation of it. And they say they put it in all caps so you can find it when you want to. And there's the Strong's Concordance. Anybody who wants to read about it can read about it. It's not a secret, so it's known. But anyway, 2 Peter 3, verse 15. Now, this is Peter writing about the Apostle Paul's letters. So this is Peter writing about Paul's letters. He says, verse 15, and regard the patience of the Lord to regard the patience of the Lord to be salvation, just as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given him, wrote to you, as also in all his letters or epistles, speaking in them of those things of which are some things hard to understand, which the unlearned and the unstable distort, as they do also the rest of the scriptures, to their own destruction. Now, what he's saying is, and this is early in the, you know, the 60s AD, Paul's letters were already scattered all over the New Testament church and recognized as inspired scripture. So, and can you imagine in those days where they didn't have Xerox machines, printing, and etc., if someone brought up, you know, these scrolls, maybe written on expensive lambskin, or there's some other possibilities. And they unroll this scroll from the great Apostle Paul, and they read, and everybody said, how inspiring that was. Can somebody make me an accurate copy of that so I'll have it, or I can read it in the church 20, 30 miles down the road? And they made copies, and if anyone made a false copy, people quickly recognized it didn't match all the others, and they burned it. Just like the Jewish tradition, if they made a mistake on the count of any of those Hebrew pages, they tore it up and burned it. So there was no fraudulent copies. The Jews punctiliously kept the Old Testament. And the Greeks have done a great job of keeping the New Testament. Plus, there are so many scattered all over. No one person could control it. But let's just say, if we, for the sake of argument, those who make the argument, that the extreme sacred language people make, let's take it to the extreme logical conclusion. If some group could have all the New Testament books under their control so they can take out the sacred name of God and switch the language from Hebrew to Greek, what else could they change? They could change anything they want. Therefore, that would call into question the authenticity, the authority, and the power of the New Testament. Think about it. That's how God preserved it, because there was too many copies around. No one, the Catholic Church actually at the time tried to control the New Testament. They burned Tyndale and a bunch of others at the stake for putting the Bible in the common man's language. It was only supposed to be in Latin and in a few monasteries. Nobody was supposed to know it. It's just something to bear in mind. I should probably conclude this. We go back to Joseph. He lived his life in the business part of his life as a man of God, and he gained a great crown for himself. Moses lived a fabulous godly life. He wrote the books that anchored the Bible, and we can, Abraham never heard sacred names. We don't have to hear them either. If we, you know, we don't need them to be saved like Abraham didn't need it. Let us live our life in a balanced way. Focus on the meaning of God's names individually, as the Spirit moves us, and we can then be part of taking all mankind into the people of God.